This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
I am torn today. We launched missiles against Syria last night. I do not want us getting involved in yet another foreign country, especially when we have Russia, who was clearly complicit. Remember, they were the ones that brokered the deal with Assad to get rid of all the nuclear weapons. So when John Kerry in the United States and Barack Obama stood up and said, "Yep, we just got rid of all the chemical weapons," now it was Russia that brokered that deal. They were the ones who said, "Yeah, they're all gone. We made sure they're all clean." Well, Russia was complicit with Assad. Now we launched last night a strike. It was actually quite brilliant in the timing for several reasons. We'll give those to you in a second. However, we're also talking about regime change. Can anyone tell me, give me one example when the United States said,
"Yeah, we want to get into regime change,"
that it either A, worked out well, or B, worked out well but cost us millions of lives? We begin there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Hello, America. Welcome to the program. It's Glenn, Pat, Stu. We also brought in Jason. Jason is my chief researcher. He's military intelligence.
And a warmonger.
Famous
warmonger.
Yeah.
He's a man who mongers in war.
He can help us work our way through a lot of this with some of the real facts that he can kind of piece together. I want you to, let me just cover a couple of things. I was concerned about Russia. But we have what Obama set up, the deconfliction line, where we called Russia in advance and we said, "Hey, by the way, we're going to blow some things up. Maybe you have 10 minutes, maybe you have 20 minutes. This is something that I'm very concerned about because I do not want to get into a war with Russia. Russia does not care about the Syrian people. America, the people at least, I think we look at those children who have been gassed and we see that and say, this guy's got to go. He's a monster. That's not what Putin is saying, because Putin doesn't care about that kind of gas. He only cares about an oil pipeline. That's the only reason why he is involved. I should say he is involved in with Iran as well, because he wants the Middle East to follow the influence of Russia, not the United States. Well, we're doing a good enough job ourselves on screwing that place up and making sure everybody in the world hates us in that part of the world. I don't want to get into a war with Vladimir Putin. There's two conflicts that we said yesterday about this time. I said, you should look into gold. You should buy gold, because if this thing starts to go unstable, you're going to see the price of gold shoot through the roof. Yesterday, last night, it was up. I don't even know what it's up now. It was up $15 last night.
The stocks are down a lot.
Yeah. I mean, the world can change overnight. Are you prepared? Because it's not just about Syria. This is also about North Korea. Now, here's where it gets brilliant. And I'm not sure that this was planned by Donald Trump. You have to be a master strategist to have this all come together this way. Couple of things. Notice we're leading not with the Democrats using the Republicans using the nuclear option. Gorsuch is going to be confirmed here in just a few minutes. And nobody's talking about the nuclear option. That is one of the biggest stories, perhaps one of the biggest political stories of our lifetime, because what it will mean for the Supreme Court for the next guy who gets out, which is probably going to be Kennedy. We're not talking about it. We're talking about a missile strike. Brilliant. Two, last night, Trump was having dinner last night with the president of China. The president of China, the big topic last night and today is, what are we going to do with North Korea? Now, Donald Trump has said, I'm going to unilaterally strike North Korea. That's crazy talk, because North Korea will attack. They have 8 nukes. They could launch a nuke, but even if they don't, they will attack South Korea, and they can level Seoul within 2.5 hours. Millions will die. The last thing we want is a unilateral attack and lobbing some missiles from a ship off the coast into North Korea, especially without the support of China. Remember, it was China that was really the force with the communists in the 1950s. That's why we have North and South Korea. China will block us. We have to have China on board. China does not want this happening on their border. So now, this morning in Mar-a-Lago, the president of China is getting up and they're having a little breakfast, staring at each other. Last night, when the president in Mar-a-Lago said, excuse me just a second, I've got to speak to the American people, he went and he said, I told you something. This is obviously not what he said, but I told you that when a president draws a red line, a president has to follow through on it. I told you this was unacceptable, and I'm just enforcing the red line that our last do-nothing president refused to enforce. He said it was unacceptable. I said it was unacceptable. I don't care what the rest of the world thinks. I don't care if it's Russia on the other side. I'm launching. He basically says that to the American people. Well, he says something different to the American people, but that's what he was saying to China. China. So he walks back with the president of China. And that's what the president of China heard. Yeah, I don't really care about Russia. I just saw that this was wrong and we're not going to tolerate it. And I don't care what the rest of the world thinks. Now, what is the president of China thinking about Donald Trump? This is a they rehearsed this for 2 days. So this is something that they had been working towards since the gassing. So this was not planned in advance for this. It just happened to fall into brilliant, almost providential timing. So what are the conversations with China going to be? Now the president of China realizes, crap, we are not dealing with Barack Obama. We're not even dealing with a guy who I think is necessarily sane. He's a guy who said the one China policy, out. And by the way, I don't care what you say. You're cheating us with trade. I want a better trade deal. Oh, and by the way, I'm willing to lob missiles and go to war alone in North Korea. The president of China, remember, their mindset is entirely different. The president of China is looking at that saying, if I'm looking at the next 500 years, I need to get past the next 4 with this guy. And this guy just might do it. This worked out really well if you are in the United States and concerned about war with North Korea. This possibly gave us the upper hand at the talks with China today, because China does not want a war, and they certainly do not want the United States going in there unilaterally. Mark my words, neither do I. I don't want a war. I don't. We have known about North Korea. And as if I may go back in a time tunnel and repeat the words of a monologue I gave in about 2003, you must take care of North Korea now, because there will be a time when you have no good options and they will have nuclear weapons. You have to be tough with them now on sanctions. Well, that time obviously is 14 years ago. We do not want a war with North Korea. We do not want a war with China. We do not want a war with Russia. And the most disturbing thing I heard from the president last night was regime change. We want regime change. Can somebody tell me the last time we set out for regime change when it worked? It's worked.
Yeah, Germany.
Germany.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the price on that one?
50 million people.
Uh-huh.
60 million.
Pretty high.
Yeah.
We had no choice but regime change. However, that regime change came in a Western country, one that we understood, one where we as the Western world were very clear, that's evil. And all of the countries, all of the Western countries that had that same kind of culture and same kind of Christian background, they all knew it. We knew, take the bad guys out, don't kill the Germans, kill all the Nazis, and we're going to be fine. Because the Germans are not necessarily Nazis. Now, tell me how clear we are as a nation that Muslims are not all Islamists. I'm not even sure our president understands that. We are looking, instead of looking at the Middle East, like we looked at Germany and said, there are Islamists, and here's how you identify them. Here's who they are. Here's what they believe. Here's what they'll do. Here are their atrocities. We instead say, these are Muslims that have just been, they're poor and they're sad and they just love peace. No, these are Muslim Islamists who will kill everyone on the planet that disagrees with them. They're throwing homosexuals off rooftops because they believe God told them to. I'm sorry. You're an Islamist. You are an enemy. Muslims are not. Now, where do we go? Who is leading that parade in America? So we have a blurry focus. Next thing. Tell me who the good guys are in the Middle East that is going to fill that vacuum. Tell me who they are. Is it Saudi Arabia? Is it the UAE? Is it Egypt? Is it Libya? I trust Jordan, and Jordan is afraid for their lives right now. Is it Iran or Iraq with the help of Russia? We have destabilized thanks to what's her name? Susan Powers. We have destabilized the entire Middle East. And we did it at first thinking, oh, well, it's like the West. We get rid of the bad guys and the good guys will have the balls to stand up. No, they won't. They don't have the ball. They're surrounded. How many good guys do you see here stand up? They don't stand up here except for patriots like Zudi Jasser because they're afraid they'll get snuffed out here. Yeah, they're going to stand up in the Middle East, surrounded by, you know, what? Let's be kind in the numbers. 1 million Islamists? It's probably more like 10 million Islamists, at least. Not going to stand up. So we destabilize. What happens? Who's going to fill that role? Well, we're not going to pick it. Russia will pick it. Oh, so we're going to put Russia and have Russia who hates the West, who's trying to correct the history of the West, who hates Israel, the only democracy and freedom in the Middle East. Oh, okay, we're going to have them do it. There are no winners here. What we look at are the children. When you look at things like Somalia, when you look at places, where was the other place, Stu? We were just talking about the other horrible tragedy that happened.
Rwanda.
Mm-hmm. Rwanda, we can help. Rwanda, we could have helped, but nobody wanted to, because why? There's nothing in it for us. That's the worst reason not to help. We could have stopped Rwanda. Can we make things better in Syria? I'm not sure. If we had a record of making any place in the Middle East better, you could make a case. Donald Trump is headed into treacherous waters. His strong base, who heard no more wars, are now beginning to turn on him this morning. His base on economic stability is very weak. On healthcare, very weak. If he gets us roped into another war, the left is going to go crazy. The uber right is going to go crazy. We could be looking at a lame duck president soon. Because of what's happening with Bannon and what's happening with Jared Kushner, what's happening inside the White House is beginning to change the presidency. We have to be very cautious. Pray for the president. Pray for our military. Pray that we have some divine providence. And last night, perhaps at least for North Korea, we had some.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
888-727-BECK.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
This is the real problem. We're talking in the break. We're going to bring Jason Petrill in. But we're talking in the break. I don't have real confidence in what this government or what this administration is doing, because it's split internally, and I don't know which side is winning. Bannon apparently was saying don't do it, and Kushner was saying do it. We did it. So this goes against everything. If you look at the Donald Trump tweets that everybody's retweeting today, he violated everything that he said, you know, was wrong with the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to go to Congress. You can't do this. Stay out of Syria. Let the Russians handle it. So it shows again, he has no moral center. Who is he listening to? That's the scary thing about this. I don't know. When he says regime change, does he really mean regime change? And what is he going to back that up with? And what does that mean? Does that mean, because Jason, what happened with the French? How did we get the Assad family in?
So, yeah, that was a French brokered deal. And the French came in and they knew that they wanted to keep everybody divided. They did not want a Sunni majority to run through. So they kept they put the Alawite minority, which is what the Assad family comes from.
Okay, so now it's falling apart because it's a puppet regime. It was manufactured. Now, who's going to do that? Us, or is it Russia? If anybody's going to put them in, go ahead. It's not going to work out well for us, but let Russia do it. At least the people will hate Russia and not us. There's no good guy here.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So let's just recap. If you just joined us last night, there was a limited response to the gassing of the Syrian people by the United States. 50 Tomahawk missiles cost us $49 million, took out an airfield. And those planes, some of them were destroyed, but the planes that were left cannot leave that airfield now. It was to cripple his ability to fly the planes and drop bombs, gas bombs, on his own people. If this is where it ends, I'm fairly comfortable with this response. However, we're talking now about what can we, you know, we have to, don't we have a responsibility to help people? Don't we have a responsibility? We have the means to stop. Well, my problem with this is that it always turns into a quagmire. It hasn't ever worked out well, at least in the Middle East. Outside of the West, it doesn't seem to work out well. And let me give you an example just from last night. Jason, what does the headline mean that just came out about Russia upping the defenses?
So, yeah, that there's a lot more there than meets the eye. If Russia sends in more S-300 missiles, their missile defense, then that means that it totally screws Israel. So Israel has been able to keep Hezbollah at bay and basically stop them from their next, you know, assault on, I mean, and that's coming too. After Syria stabilizes, the next assault is Hezbollah into the Golan Heights, mark my words. But the only thing keeping them from doing that is Israel sending in planes, and they do a strike every other month or so, and they take out a weapons cache. Well, now that basically takes that out. Israel's not going to be able to fly in there with those S-300s in. So that's a big step back for...
So last night, we think we did good, but actually now with the response from Russia, it's actually hurting Israel. Now, Israel was with us on this strike last night. Israel, well, they weren't with us, but they immediately came out and said they approve. Australia did the same thing. They approve. But how is this going to affect down the road? That's the problem, is we butt our nose into people's business and we think we're making it better, and we always compromise and we're like, okay, well, this guy's better than the other guy. Well, but the other guy is really bad. And sometimes that guy's overthrown and then you get ISIS. Not good.
You know, I'm no Middle East expert, but if I could suggest something that I think could work would be to give Assad a Pepsi. A lot of times real disagreements are broken down, if particularly if you send Kendall Jenner there, to hand Assad right. a Pepsi. And I think a lot, what would probably happen is the people around would start cheering.
Yeah.
And the walls would break down. And I would say Jews and Syrians are hugging in minutes, really. I mean, that's just I'm throwing it out there.
Just throw it out there.
I think it's something we should consider. And I don't know if Trump or Bannon, I don't know who's the right guy to go to with that. But I mean, I do think Kendall Jenner needs to be involved.
I know that we've tried to teach the world to sing. In perfect
harmony, right?
It did not work out. So just forget about the singing. Just drink this.
Right.
And I think he would trust anybody from the United States bringing him something to drink right now.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Here,
oh,
just
sure.
Drink this. It'll make
that
everything
actually might
better.
Solve the problem if we do it right. It's tough, man. I, you know, you're right. We all kind of agreed off the air that if this is the full response, and that there's a one day of a few missiles to an airfield, we're sending a little bit of a message. We're saying we'll act unilaterally, which has some good repercussions to others.
It's
a small step.
It gives the president his first international test, mm-hmm. which is always important.
Show strength.
Don't screw with us.
Mm-hmm. No kidding.
Show strength. So there's some, if this was it, we could say, okay, you know what, there's some positives there. You know, but I worry about anything extended. But even then, even with that little tiny thing, we're seeing a Russian response where they're adding, you know, air defenses, which makes our ability to handle the situation with ISIS in Syria more difficult. It expands the rift between us and Russia, which is obviously not positive. And in addition to that, the Israel situation we just talked about. And that's just off of one night. I mean, that's the problem with these things, is it's impossible. It's like government trying to manage an economy. A lot of times their abilities, you know, their intentions are great. They want to help people and they want to do all these things, but it's just too complicated a process and it never works. And that's kind of where I am now on these things. They make me more nervous because we can never seem to handle it. And that's not even a commentary on Trump or Obama or any president. I mean, you could pick anyone you want.
The last 50 years.
Yeah, it's just impossible.
Look, I shouldn't say the last 50 years. This has been happening since Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt said, we have a responsibility now. We are so big and so powerful and so rich that we have a responsibility to police the rest of the world. And that's where we went. We started in with South America. And mistake after why are there so many communists down there? Why is there such an anti-American and really conspiracy kind of central of the CIA is just because that's what we did, because all that stuff is true. We did prop up puppet dictators down there. We did meddle with influence, and it doesn't work out well. It just doesn't work out well.
I would argue that. So we were saying off air, this is the hardest situation ever. And you hear like Senator Marco Rubio talk about, go in regime change. You know, you hear destabilization. There's ways for us to win, I think, on this without any more action. And it all runs through Russia. I think it all runs through Russia. Really, the only reason Assad is in power right now is because Russia is the grantor of their stability and the regime right now. Everything runs through Russia. And I would actually argue that Russia's long game has always been to gain concessions elsewhere in the world. Really, nobody has a dog in the Syria fight. I mean, it's not.
Well, they do. They want the pipeline.
I don't think so. I really don't.
What? They have no freshwater port.
We want the pipeline.
The pipeline or the port?
The port. Sorry, the port.
So the port. I don't see. Again, nothing is stopping them from going somewhere else and getting it's a weak naval port. There's nothing stopping them from going elsewhere and getting another one. I mean, it's easily replaceable.
Where?
But they're not going to war over that port. They're just not. I mean, they could get it in Greece. They could get it in. They're kicking back up the Balkans again. You know, Serbia, the Balkan areas. That's the next flashpoint that'll happen. But I don't think anyone's going to war over Syria. But it's everyone's playing Syria for their own goals right now. And I think eventually Russia can broker a deal where they win. It looks like we win. Even if Assad stays in power and the family doesn't go, even if he just keeps them under control and saying, the U.S.
What's
is going
the
to
family like, Jason?
The
Assad family. Dad's really bad. What about everybody else?
The dad was really bad. He was the one. He did the same thing Assad did when he first came into power. He did a huge suppression back in the 70s, I believe.
Yeah.
And he killed almost as many people as Assad did. Assad got into power basically, and he ended up doing the same thing his dad did. He thought that it would work. Hey, it worked for dad. It's going to work for me. He wasn't expecting the Arab Spring. So it didn't go well for him. I don't know too much about his family members, his sons and all that going forward.
Asma al-Assad, we know a lot about her. She has dark brown eyes, wavy chin-length brown hair, long neck, and energetic grace. No jewelry apart from Chanel agates around her neck. Not even a wedding ring, but fingernails lacquered in dark blue-green. She's breezy, conspiratorial, and fun. Her accent is English.
Wait. She's breezy, conspiratorial. And fun.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. That should be InfoWars guy.
Alex Jones?
Yeah, Alex Jones. He's breezy. He's conspiratorial.
And fun.
Are you reading this from Match.com? Where are you reading this?
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah,
well, let me give you the rest. Her accent is English, but not plummy. Despite what must be a killer IQ, she sometimes uses urban shorthand. Such as
like
I was like
Teen Beat.
Close. It was a legitimate profile. 2011 Vogue. It was called A Rose in the Desert, and they praised her as a fashion icon just before they all started gassing their people. And it was an amazing view of the mainstream media. And by the way, it's almost impossible to find online. There's, if any, full copies of it exist. I don't know. I've already ordered a copy of the actual magazine.
Oh, we need one for the museum.
Yeah. But it's true. I mean, like, think about that. That's how they looked at her at that time. And it was, you remember, you see, there's, who was it? Was it Feinstein that went over there with Assad? We've seen, before this started, the left loved this guy. He was, they were fans of Assad. They liked she was a modern Western woman. I mean, seriously, I swear to you, one of the first lines in this story, if I can find it real quick, it is a secular country where women earn as much as men.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, yes, they're gassing their people, but pay equality. So I don't know. There's no wage gap there. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
Well, there's no wage gap because they've killed a lot of the men.
That's true.
So they kind of need everybody on board.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So I don't know how this show derailed, and all of a sudden we're in the break. We're looking up the Assad.
The breezy
Assad.
Thin-limbed.
The freshest, wife. Most magnetic of freshmen.
She's really pretty. And then we started, yeah, but she's no, you know, Queen of Jordan. And we started looking her up. And then the battle is, yeah, but she's no Melania Trump. I mean, yeah. this is what this show has turned into.
Well, we're actually winning this battle now, finally.
Like, yes.
I mean,
we have won the last two presidents.
What's that?
We have won the battle, the last two presidents.
For the hottest first lady?
Yeah.
No, I'm saying the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, you're just talking I'm about sorry. Her abs.
Oh, no. Well, her arms. We're talking just arms. I don't think there's a question, okay. Obviously, Michelle. Yeah.
And you wouldn't want a first lady who isn't known for her arms and then takes a picture of her arms folded. You know what I mean?
Oh, my gosh.
That was so insulting, right? That whole arms folded thing, even though it looked exactly like the painting, the very famous painting of Kennedy, who has his arms folded.
And Obama.
Well, and Obama, the picture that was in every airport and behind every FBI desk in the country with his arms folded. But
what's your point? I mean,
I don't know. What's her name? Asthma?
Yeah. She's named after a disease. That's kind of weird.
No, it's not.
What, Assad?
Yeah, asthma, Al-Assad.
Oh, asthma, two diseases, Assad and asthma. So what do you think the real goal of Vladimir Putin is? If it's not the port and the pipeline.
So I think Putin has always been in Syria, one, to distract us, because it's just great when the United States is bogged down in Middle East wars.
Us in Afghanistan in
exactly.
the
80s. Yes. Yep. And it's allowed him to get stronger in Eastern Europe. It allowed him to move into Georgia, allowed him to move into Ukraine. But I think now the point of him staying in there is to eventually gain some kind of concession. So I said before that he doesn't have a major dog in that fight. We don't have a major dog in that fight. So no one, if anyone's nervous today about going to war, I don't think that there's a larger chance of us going to war. There's always the chance someone does something crazy, and that always foils everything. But I don't think there's a large chance of us going to war. But I think Russia can, and this is a way for everybody to win. I think they're going to hold out and eventually get concessions. Concessions on the sanctions. Remember those sanctions
against
that everyone...
them.
What's that?
Against Russia.
Right. The sanctions
because
against Russia. Because of Crimea.
Ukraine,
and Eastern Ukraine.
Yep.
I think they'll hold out and eventually either they'll dangle that out for their support, or Trump, if he's smart, will take that out of his pocket and lay it on the table first and say, look, support us. Keep aside, rein him in. If you do... then how about those sanctions? Now we'll release them. But Putin could, he could actually get the geopolitical motherlode on this. He could eventually get concessions on those sanctions, get those wiped out. He could also get the anti-ballistic missile shield removed from Eastern Europe. I mean, then he would be like, okay, you guys do what you want. We'll pack up. The very next day, they'll pack up and leave Syria for good. They'll never come back. I mean, they really don't care. That's the only reason I think they're there.
If you're a conspiracy theorist... and think that Donald Trump is in bed with Russia to a level where they're playing games. If that happens, that seems providential for Russia, doesn't it?
Well, it'll piss me off if people say that, if people make the argument that Trump is in bed with Russia after this, say, oh, see, we told you he was going to release those sanctions. I just see that as good diplomacy right there. I don't see that as a bad thing. And the anti-ballistic missile shield, you could argue it was a Bush-era initiative. That shouldn't even have happened. You could make the argument that our relations with Russia declined after that happened.
Anybody else?
That should have happened.
Moved, though, by the fact that this was the big anti-war guy, right? He was against Iraq the whole time. Obama shouldn't do anything about Syria. You got to go to Congress. We shouldn't be doing these things. We got to stay out of it. It hasn't even been 100 days yet, and he's launched a missile attack against a sovereign nation. I think that's It's fairly ironic.
It is. And how many times did we say in the run-up, because there were some levels of opposition to Trump on the right that were saying, well, we don't like this. We don't like that he's not wants to be involved and he's isolationist. Bull crap.
He's not.
That's not who he is at all. It never was a real criticism of him. If anything, you're going to be worried about Trump bombing too many places, not too few.
Do you think that if he wouldn't have had so many losses within his first 100 days, that he would have launched that attack? I bet you he wouldn't.
I think he would have listened to Bannon because Bannon would have had a better record.
Right. I agree.
You know, and he doesn't tire of winning.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
Man, we have spent the last hour talking about the powerful people in the world. Putin, Trump, President of China, even Assad, the North Korean dictator. The most powerful person in the world perhaps doesn't even believe it. The most powerful person that I know is you. If you set your mind to it and you believe that you can truly make a difference, if all of us do that, the world changes. I'm going to introduce you next to a guy who believes he can change the world by convincing you you can change the world. We go there right now.
Of entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Leon Logothetis. He is he's a man who is running a documentary called The Kindness Diaries on Netflix. You can see it, and he's traveling the world on a mission of kindness. I'll let him explain it, but I'm first. I want to just find out who you are. What's your background? Where are you from?
Sure. So I used to be a broker in the city of London. On the outside, I had everything. And on the inside, I had nothing. Emotionally, spiritually bankrupt. And I happened across the movie The Motorcycle Diaries, which is a romanticized version of Che Guevara traveling around South America, giving back to people.
Okay, hang on just a second. When you say a romanticized version of Che Guevara, what do you mean by that?
It wasn't the real image of Che the murderer. Right. It was the nice version of Che giving back.
So I just wanted to make sure you knew who Che Guevara was.
Absolutely.
Yes, okay.
And there was something about that movie that inspired me because he was giving back in a profound way. And I decided that I was going to quit my job and start traveling the world relying on kindness.
So Che has done something good then. As we see, at least he inspired you. If nothing else,
exactly in the movie.
Yeah,
that's why I always preface it by saying the romanticized version. Right.
Yeah, it's really interesting you say it because you walked in the studios and you said, "I love your artwork of Winston Churchill," and we just had a quick conversation of Winston Churchill, who you adore perhaps even more than I do, and I think Winston Churchill is one of the greatest men to ever live. And so for you to say Che Guevara changed my life is kind of like,
interesting.
Whoa, how does that fit?
Yeah. I mean, and some people say that to me. They're like, you know, Che wasn't a hero to many, obviously, but simply just the movie.
Yeah. Okay.
Have you watched the movie?
I have not, just because I know who Che is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I quit my job and I started to travel the world relying on kindness.
What does that mean?
It means that I had no money. I had no food. I had no place to stay. All I had was my vintage yellow motorbike called Kindness One, sort of like Air Force One, but a little bit yellower. And I would give back to unsuspecting Good Samaritans life-changing gifts based on being helped by them. And they had no idea what was going on. And it was really just relying on kindness.
So it's kind of like the New Testament, make no, don't worry about tomorrow. Don't worry about where you're going, where you're going to sleep, what you're going to eat. Just go and do good.
That was the aim.
Okay. And what do you mean, first of all, how are they kind to you? By giving you a place to sleep? By what?
Yeah, primarily it was human interaction, human connection. So if I felt connected to someone and they felt connected to me, they would maybe give me some gas. They would maybe put me up in their house. They would maybe give me some food. And then I'd go from them to the next person. For example, I met a homeless chap in Pittsburgh who, you know, had nothing really except one bag. Yet he offered for me to sleep on the streets with him. He offered to protect me. He offered to feed me. He offered to give me some clothes. Wow. And that was an act of kindness based on, you know, he didn't know what was going to happen. But I was fortunate enough to be able to put him up in a house and send him back to school. But really, it was that he taught me a really powerful lesson, that true wealth is not in our wallets, but it's in our hearts. Does that mean that money's not important? Of course not. Money is very important. But the truest of wealth comes from in here.
So how do you mean you were lucky enough to be able to send him back to school and put him up in a house?
Sure. So I've had many opportunities. You know, I worked in the City of London. I had financial security. So what I mean lucky enough is that I had the means to give back to him. I had the means to give him an opportunity.
So when you say you had no money, you didn't literally have
no
money.
You were just pretending.
Exactly. So I was doing a social experiment. Mm-hmm. In my everyday life, of course, I have money. But in that moment, for those 6 months, I had no money. Mm. And I was relying on kindness.
Did you take your like a credit card with you just in case?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Really?
No,
you had no backup plan?
We were filming the Netflix show. So I had a crew. And the crew would stay.
And a catering truck.
A what?
And a catering truck.
Oh, man. Got some brain.
You were really homeless.
This is like the man, truck man versus wild, is it?
Now, what's interesting is that the crew would film, and then they would leave. Mm-hmm. And I have a book as well, and in the book, there's many moments that are not in the film because the crew weren't there. Mm. So, for example, that night with Tony, there was a moment where another homeless chap was having a little bit of a moment, let's say, but no one filmed that. Because no one was there except me and Tony and this other chap.
That's really interesting. So was there a moment where you were like looking at this and you're saying, you know, you have this crew there. Were the people suspicious of you?
Sure. Look, I think ultimately I would go up to people without the camera. Because if you just go up to someone with a camera, they're like, you know, please get out of my face.
Yeah, right.
So I'd explain what I was doing. And then if they were willing to help or if they were willing not to help, and they were willing to be on camera, I'd say, look, we have a camera crew. Are you okay to be filmed? Oh. That's really how it would go.
Mm. So with this homeless guy, you bought him a house?
No, I put him up in a house.
Okay.
So he now lives in an apartment.
Really nice. That's wow.
And he's gone back to school, and how's he doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a Hollywood ending. Yeah. So unfortunately, homelessness isn't just it's not just physical, it's also
mental.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So he found himself in some trouble, but he's got back on his feet, he's back in a house, and I'm working to get him back into school. But it's not a Hollywood ending. I wish it was.
Yeah. I would imagine.
Those are very hard to find. We know, what's his name, Gardner?
Chris
Gardner. From The Pursuit of Happiness.
Okay.
Know him quite well. And those endings are few
rare.
And far between.
Yes,
rare.
They are.
Yeah. It's interesting to look at that and say, so you go through this process, and obviously the stories are kind of about changing other people. But I'd imagine that, like, there is a huge change that happened in you going through this process.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, so who is really helping who?
I think we're both helping each other. You know, that's the reality. I mean, when I did the journey, when you get such kindness, when you meet people who open their hearts up in such a beautiful way, you can't help but be changed. And I was definitely changed. I was changed by Tony.
How?
Because he had nothing. Yet he had everything. And it was like the opposite of me, because on the outside I had everything, on the inside I had nothing. And this chap on the inside had everything, and the outside had nothing.
What do you mean by everything?
He came from his heart. He showed kindness. He was open-hearted. And I think many of us live up here.
Yeah.
I know that I did. And he taught me how to live down here. It wasn't just like that. It wasn't just like I met Tony and it all changed. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of the catalyst. It was another moment like, whoa, there's a chap that has nothing on the outside. And we're taught that you have to have everything on the outside. Don't get me wrong, living on the streets is not fun. This guy was doing it for years. There are many people who do it for their whole lives.
You said it all when you said he would protect you.
Yes.
I mean, that's, yeah. mm-hmm. that to me, that's, you know, you... I'm sorry, but you know, I know you're British, but to say chap doesn't even, it dresses homelessness up too much for an American. Were you afraid when he, you know, when, because that is a part of being homeless. It's extraordinarily dangerous. Mental illness is a real problem with homelessness. Some people are homeless for a reason. They are social misfits, and they like being social misfits. The drugs, it's a dangerous world.
That's a great question. And I was told specifically on that night not to stay in this specific park. Yeah, prior to meeting Tony, I was walking the streets and I said, look, don't stay in this park past sundown. Yet when I met him, he said to me, you can stay with me. Every part of my body was like, do not stay on the streets of Pittsburgh. But there was this one little small voice that said, you have to stay with this man. And I followed that voice, and it was correct. Because like I said, he did protect me. And my intuition just guided me to that moment.
You a religious man at all?
I wouldn't say religious. I would say spiritual? I'm a man of faith, spiritual, yes. Okay.
So is that new for you?
It was, yes. It's not anymore, but it was. I believe you can't have experiences like that with Tony and not change and not... Yeah.
Not feel that you're connected somehow.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Did you spend nights without a place to live, a place to stay, and days without food?
Yes, not days without food. I would always find someone to give me some food, but there were times when
every day somebody gave you
yes.
food.
Yes. Wow. Yes. Wow. It's truly amazing.
Just sometimes you didn't have a shelter.
Exactly. And I would sleep in the sidecar.
There was a study that came out this week that said that while the wealthy do give, the proportion is way out of whack. The poorer you are, the more likely you are to give big. You know, you'll give half of what you have. Did you find a difference while you're on the street? What did you learn about giving?
Look, what I learned was that people who don't have a lot often have a sense of community that people who have a lot don't have. And when you have this sense of community, you just give. Like I was in India, and I ended up sleeping in the slums with this rickshaw driver and his family. Mm. And although on the outside, I would never want to sleep in the slums, I would never want to live in the slums, there was a sense of community in that place that was just second to none.
People don't have any idea when you say slums what Indian slums are like. That is poverty.
Raw sewage on the streets.
Right. We all obviously have our own struggles. You know, for example, the voice recognition in my car almost never recognizes what I said. but I would imagine going through this is something where like those types of problems are put in a completely different perspective for you now.
When you went back, were you a little grossed out by your former lifestyle?
I was grossed out by the way that I was living on the outside. I was grossed out by the fact that I had no, in those days, sense of connection. I was grossed out by the fact that I didn't have a sense of community, that I wasn't coming from my heart, that I wasn't being kind, that I was focused on one thing and that was just making money. There's nothing wrong with making money. But when you just make money and you don't come from your heart and you don't give back, that grossed me out.
You having a hard time holding it?
What do you mean?
You having a hard time going back into the world and holding tight to what you had when you were on the streets?
It's a great question, and sometimes yes, but I made a commitment to myself. And I said to myself that I was going to commit to this way of life, imperfectly, because no one's perfect, but I was going to do everything in my power to come from a place of kindness. I was going to do everything in my power to see another human being, because for many years I wasn't seen.
What happened to you that... I mean, you just don't wake up one morning and go, you know what, I want to give it all up. What happened to you?
So what happened to me was that on an emotional level, I was in deep pain. Many of us are in pain, yet we don't face it. And the pain was so great.
Do you mind explaining the pain? You don't have to.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I was just very, very depressed. I never felt seen in my home and also at school. I never felt like I was following my purpose. And it was just, it reached a point where it just broke. The dam broke. And leaving my job was the only thing I could do because the pain was just too much. And that's, had the pain not been that much, I wouldn't have done it.
No.
I would have still been there.
It bothers me that we live in a society now that wants to take away pain and suffering. And I don't mean this like, you know, we got to help suffering people, but we don't want anybody to fail. We don't want our kids to fail. We want to swoop in. There's always a drug for something. There's always a bailout for something. Every lesson of real importance that I've ever learned came from the bottom of my soul. You know, a place I didn't want to be. That's where I found out who I was. That's when I actually grew. When I'm just kind of drifting along and everything is okay and I'm just kind of even numb, there's no growth there. I don't connect with anyone. I don't reach outside of myself.
It's interesting. You're a Winston Churchill fan.
Yeah.
And Winston Churchill has a very famous quote, as I'm sure you know, which is, when you find yourself walking through hell, keep walking. And it, you know, pain is not pleasant.
No.
But if you find your way through it, there's a lot of light comes your way.
Mm-hmm. What do you have to tell us about, you know, here in America and in Europe too? Things are getting bad. Things are, you know it, over in the UK. There's trouble coming our way. And I am convinced the biggest trouble that we face is from us, not from the governments or anybody trying to kill us, but from us. We don't have a sense of community anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't trust each other. We don't trust our institutions. And, you know, de Tocqueville came from France and studied America and said in the 1800s, what made America great is America was good. And we've let institutions and governments do things for us, and we're losing our kindness. When you saw the streets of all over the world, and then you saw the streets of America, is there a difference in America, or is it the same? Are we more callous? Are we kinder? Or are we like everybody else?
I think ultimately one of the greatest lessons I learned was that everyone simply, wherever you are, doesn't matter what religion you are, doesn't matter what color you are, simply just wants to be seen. And by being seen, I mean being loved, being heard, having a sense of community. And in the Western world, we come too much from our heads. We come too much from our iPhones. We come too much from being connected, but not really being connected. And I would say just simplify things. I go and I speak at schools all the time, and I tell them, look, each and every one of you can change the world. And you can simply change the world by being kind to each other, by coming from your heart. It's such a simple thing. And being connected and just dropping down from the madness.
Leon Logothetis, he's got a new book out and Netflix documentary called The Kindness Diaries. It is a pleasure to meet you, sir. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
Glenn Beck Program.
Man, I have so much respect for people like Leon and, you know, James Altucher. He's the, Jeff, you look him up. I can't think of a darn thing. I keep mixing him up with Malcolm Gladwell. We've had him on the show. He's a big investor.
Yeah, he looks very familiar.
Yeah, we have. He's angel been here investor. He's a brilliant times. Man. Brilliant man. $14 million in the bank and everything else. And he decided, you know what, I am all about my stuff. And he sold and got rid of everything, his house, his car, his clothes. He put three outfits in a bag. He took his cell phone, his computer, put it in another bag. He lives now in Airbnbs. He, you know, doesn't own a car. He has no possessions.
If it can't be carried in his bag, no possessions.
That's a big change.
We have to get him on because he is saying
that's interesting.
The things he's learning living a life with no possessions is pretty amazing. Our serial last episode of Calvin Coolidge. You don't want to miss it. It's next.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
As one examines the life of America's 30th president, Calvin Coolidge, one thing becomes crystal clear. He is, without doubt, the most underrated, underappreciated president in U.S. history. After the Woodrow Wilson years had wrongly magnified the office of the presidency to near monarch-like status, Coolidge reversed all of that, as Amity Schlaes, author of the book Coolidge, explains.
He was walking along outside one day with a senator named Selden Spencer, and the senator was trying to jolly the often glum Coolidge up to cheer him up, and he said, "I wonder who lives in that pretty house with the white pillars over there." And Coolidge said, "Nobody. They just come and go."
Coolidge returned the constitutional balance of power. His hands-off or laissez-faire approach to government meddling in the economy, coupled with a slashing of the federal spending and cutting of taxes, led to virtually full employment and the most prosperous decade perhaps in the history of mankind, the Roaring Twenties.
It worked great. We had strong growth, 4% growth, the kind of growth that political candidates aspire to today. We had low unemployment, and the patent rate was through the roof. The patents of the 1920s are still studied, you know, in scholarly journals because inventors were so excited. And the reason for all this growth was the pullback of government, but also the assurance that government wasn't going to stop pulling back. People believed, well, this is the new way. There wasn't this great uncertainty of an erratic government. It turned out that that wasn't accurate. The government did expand again on a little bit under Hoover and a lot under Franklin Roosevelt, but there was a sense that the private sector was winning. Coolidge said, the chief business of the American people is business, the chief ideal of the American people is idealism, and he meant both.
He was a fierce advocate for civil rights for minorities, granting citizenship to Native Americans and fighting for equality for blacks. Critics on the left, they often point to the Immigration Act he signed into law in 1924, which dramatically choked off the flow of immigrants to America as proof that Coolidge was a racist. But that argument really falls apart pretty quickly, since the immigration at the time was coming from Europe, so it was almost exclusively white. With the U.S. population at the time of 99 million, taking in some 25 million new immigrants from 1871 to 1914 was massive and an overwhelming challenge. Coolidge and the Congress wanted to give the nation a chance to assimilate those that were already here. The most controversial element of the bill was a ban on Japanese citizens in the United States. David Petruzza, author of Calvin Coolidge, a documentary biography, explains the 30th president's problem.
Coolidge opposed this. His Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, opposed this. And they went back and forth with Congress several times on that. But in fact, what happens is that there is a steamroller going through the Congress to restrict immigration and to restrict the Japanese. And he cannot do this. He cannot fight back against this. If he does veto the bill, what it will do is crash the entire immigration system, which was expiring by statute.
The fact was, Europe was a hotbed of trouble in nearly every country from which the immigrants were coming.
Remember, the backdrop is revolution in just about every country in Europe. So almost revolution in England, definitely revolution in Germany, certainly ominous revolution in Russia, and so on. Did we want a revolution here? No. And many of the immigrants here were quite interested in the revolutions over there, Sacco and Vanzetti. So Coolidge was restrictionist, as his party was, and he signed the Johnson Act, a quota-based immigration restriction.
Coolidge had a presidency of firsts. He was the first to light the national Christmas tree in 1923. He gave the first presidential radio address. And he was the first to broadcast his inaugural address nationwide. It's strange that he was the first voice to be heard because he was also a man of very few words. Once, when someone asked him why he spoke so infrequently, he said,
"If you don't say anything, you won't be called upon to repeat it."
One of the few missteps of Coolidge's presidency couldn't have been foreseen. Coolidge had one shot at appointing a Supreme Court justice during his time in office. To fill the role, he eagerly turned to his close friend and Attorney General Harlan Fiske Stone. Stone came with an excellent resume of conservatism, and Coolidge confidently nominated him to the court. Sadly, as this has happened many times since, within a year, Stone was siding with hardcore progressives, court decisions, and progressives like Louis Brandeis. Later, when conservatives like Chief Justice Hughes joined together to strike down several of FDR's New Deal laws, Stone was part of the progressive element of the heavily divided court. He became so reliable as a progressive that in 1941, FDR made him the Chief Justice. Fortunately, Coolidge didn't live long enough to see the decisions of those he had trusted tear down so much of what he had built. And what he had built was unprecedented. He had strictly adhered to the United States Constitution. He helped pull the nation out of a deep depression in just a year. He ushered in a kind of prosperity the country, in fact, the world, had never even before witnessed.
When I was writing the Coolidge book, I often asked myself, why aren't I writing the biography of the 20s, the roaring 20s, because they were real. Our kids, Great Gatsby notwithstanding, our kids read Great Gatsby and they think the 20s were a lie. On the contrary, they were admirable. That was the period when we got Saturday off because our productivity gains were so great. So think of it as the decade that gave you Saturday.
As the next election neared, the Republican Party was thrilled to have a wildly popular incumbent president to run again. The trouble was, the wildly popular president was still really despondent over the death of his beloved son. As the party bosses continued to hound him about running for a second term of his own, Coolidge traveled to South Dakota.
So the question was, would he run in 28? It would only be the second time. Why not? The Republican Party adored him. They said, this is our man. He was deeply popular, Coolidge. Of course he'll run again. How can you leave a sure thing? Of course he'll run again. But in the summer of 1927, Coolidge went to South Dakota for a vacation and also to conciliate. He wanted to placate the farmers whom he had not given a subsidy, whom he had denied a subsidy with vetoes. So there was sort of a political part to this summer trip as well. And there he was in South Dakota in Rapid City, making a summer White House in the high school. You can visit that. And living in a lodge out in the park.
It was there on that spot that the president made a decision, inspired by the carvings on Mount Rushmore.
What's going on in the park? The sculptor Gutzon Borglum is sculpting Mount Rushmore. And he wants, what does every artist want when he's working on something like that? An appropriation or a further appropriation for this enormous gargantuan project. So in Coolidge's mind, you have to think of the summer. He's trying to decide 27, whether to run again. He's trying to decide about, you know, maybe visit this giant sculpture. Gutzon Borglum is just getting going. It's all together. And in August, Coolidge hands out a notice. I'm not going to run again. I do not choose to run again. The country is stunned.
Coolidge would later write in his autobiography that the biggest factor in not running was that the joy was sucked out of his life with the death of his son. But it really was the trip to Mount Rushmore that helped Coolidge decide against another term, as Amity Schles explains.
Coolidge goes up to Rushmore on a horsey to see how Gutzon Borglum is doing, maybe to hand some dynamite over. And you can see from the video that Coolidge is grossed out. And of course he would be, because what is Mount Rushmore? It's about superheroes. It's kind of Nietzschean, right? Big figures. T.R., Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington. oh, remember what the Coolidge might not like all that TR did for the Republican Party. And he looks at it, and you can see his ambivalence. You can see his disgust, and you can see how fast he turns away.
So Coolidge determined then and there in that summer of 1927 while in Rapid City, South Dakota, that he would walk away from the power of the presidency.
So there it is, exactly what he doesn't want to be, the exact reason he doesn't want to stay in office. And he writes in his autobiography, after a while, the president gets vain. The president is surrounded by yes men, and he starts to believe in his own grandeur. And he actually says in his autobiography, it's a great safety, I'm paraphrasing here, so it may not be precisely, but it's a great safety for the president and the country and a great comfort to them for the president to know he is not a great man.
Calvin Coolidge's death came just weeks ahead of the inauguration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, whose New Deal presidency would usher in an era of massive federal expansion. So in hindsight, Coolidge said something at the end of his life that seems really appropriate. He told a friend, quote, I feel I no longer fit in with these times, end quote. He didn't. And now in the century since Coolidge's passing, it seems like any defender of the Constitution wouldn't fit in with any time since his. Coolidge may not have considered himself a great man, but as we reflect on his incredible career, perhaps he would excuse us if we were to judge him so.
Glenn Beck.
Unbelievable.
He's got no choice because I think he was a great man.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A great man. That story where he goes to Rushmore and sees it being sculpted in
and is grossed out.
Especially the giant image of Theodore Roosevelt, who he didn't like his policies. He didn't like the way he
ended
up.
He's a progressive.
Yeah. And it just turned him off. And he's like, not what we're supposed to be about.
And that's not who I want to be. And what I love about it is the ending where he's saying, you become blind to the truth that you're not a great man. You're surrounded by people who are yes men. Boy, that kind of humility is really scarce.
Sure is. George Washington, Calvin Coolidge. I think those
Abraham
are
the, Lincoln.
Maybe
I think
Lincoln
too.
Yeah.
Maybe.
No, I think Abraham Lincoln, if you can even call it this, his only arrogance came from a true belief that he was a man of destiny and not a man in destiny of get out of my way, a man of, oh crap, I don't want to do this. I mean, I really believe he was truly humble and only did what he felt he was really supposed to
do. The difference between the two, though, is Coolidge strictly adhered to the Constitution.
Yes.
Lincoln
yes.
did not.
Yes. He was. So. Coolidge is. I am a fan of Coolidge.
Oh, man.
He is definitely top three. He might be two. He might be number two as far as presidents.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
Hello, America. So the alt-right is going absolutely nuts about the strike against Syria. And the reason why is because he was really sold, and he sold himself as an anti-war president and a guy who's not going to be involved. And he spoke over and over and over again about not getting involved in Syria. Let Russia take care of this, correct? He made a big deal out of you've got to go to Congress. Barack Obama's got to go to Congress before he does anything in Syria. Well, that's not what he did. Now, the people on the alt-right and the big anti-war people who believed Donald Trump was that kind of guy, now we're very upset. This is going to cause problems in the White House. I'll explain it to you next.
We are one.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
Really better be careful when I tell you that the Republicans used the nuclear option last night because of all the things that are going on. That was in Congress for the SCOTUS vote. Supreme Court justice going to be voted on today. It's probably going to come out, what, 55-48?
52-48, probably.
Well, they could have added a few more senators. 100 isn't necessarily a hard, fast rule.
Yeah. 55-45?
It is.
I think it's because there was two votes that happened last night. And the second one was for an up or down vote, and I think it went 55-45. One was to stop it, and that went down party lines. Yep. And this one is expected now that Schumer released everybody and said, look, if you're in a red state and you got to vote, we got to vote. And that's when that vote went 55-45. So they got a few Democrats.
Yeah, you'll get Heitkamp, Donnelly, Manchin.
That's what's going to probably happen here in a few minutes. So you're going to have a new Supreme Court
justice.
Oh, I
know the story. I was just making fun of your math skills.
Shut up. and then gold is up. Stock market is down. And the world is in real chaos. And I don't know how to predict the White House. I'm going to give you a couple of stories. Stockholm, three people are dead this morning. There was a terror attack. What's going to happen with North Korea? And I want to talk to you politically here for a second and give you a scenario that I think is, you may not agree, but I think likely to happen. And we go there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Let me tell you about the war that is happening right now with the Trump supporters. The alt-right, who love Russia and do not want us in war. In fact, the alt-right is very nationalist, but they want to pull back and bring the armies back into the United States. And they saw Donald Trump as a guy who would do that. And the reason why they saw him as that guy is because he said that's who he was. I don't believe that. I haven't believed that. You know, here's a guy who said we can't get mixed up in Iran, in Iraq. Let Russia take care of Syria. And last night he made a very bold and decisive move. It's a risky move. I think with the timing of China being in there, I think it was providential because I'm hoping that it will show China that this guy will move on his own and they don't want us moving in North Korea. I don't want to be moving in North Korea, but something has to be done and maybe China will get involved in this and maybe they will stop North Korea. Time will tell. But I want to take you down the road and move ahead and let's just look at things that are possible and ask, are they probable to happen? You're already seeing Donald Trump having historic lows of what, 37% approval rating?
Yeah, he's ranging between 36 and 43, 44.
Okay. And historic lows. No president has ever been that low
at this fast point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's certainly moving that along quicker than, because I mean, most presidents hit a low point, and this low point is not historically low for a president.
No, but it is at this point because of the honeymoon.
Right. There's usually a honeymoon period where everyone's at 65% for a few months.
Okay. So why is his approval rating that low? Well, it started pretty low in the first place. And then he did the Muslim ban, which wasn't a Muslim ban, but he called it a Muslim ban or a ban when he signed it. It was thrown together. And who threw it together? Who led that?
I mean, it was a Bannon.
It was a Bannon.
Bannon move.
Okay, Bannon move. Then that hurt him badly. Then the next thing that he did.
And remember, also, they brought it back up and it's again been overturned. So it's correct. Happened twice now.
Correct. Then he starts with healthcare. And who is the architect of healthcare? Paul Ryan and Bannon. And Bannon is the one that says, don't worry, you're going to be able to get the Freedom Caucus to fold. You just hold their feet to the fire and tell them that they're going to be primaried and you'll get them to fold.
In fact, Bannon was reportedly the one who actually delivered that message along with Mulvaney to the Freedom Caucus in that battle.
How'd that work out?
Did not work out. Freedom Caucus are elected representatives and they actually think for themselves.
And how did that work out for Donald Trump?
Did not work out well. It's not helped.
And
because he was a big supporter of that Ryan healthcare bill. I mean, he went, as they said, he's even when they were trying to give him credit, the Ryans of the world said he expended incredible energy and political capital to try to get that done.
So now a guy who does not like to lose, Donald Trump, has listened to advice from Bannon twice and has lost bigly. So now what's happening? Bannon is saying, cut off the Uber right. Kirshner, the son-in-law of Donald Trump, who has been put in charge about almost everything big in the White House, by all accounts, really, really smart, really, really good, but a Democrat and not a fan of Bannon. They're now in a death match behind the scenes, according to some. Bannon has said, I like a good gunfight. Well, I like a good gunfight, but I like a good gunfight where it's fair. And here's why it's not fair. Here's why it's not a fair fight for you, because you're fighting the sheriff's son, the sheriff's daughter. The sheriff's not going to let that go on too long. The sheriff is not going to allow you to off his son-in-law. So forget about gunfights. Let's look at what's probable. Kirshner is bringing in Democrats now to the White House, and the allies of Bannon has said there is a war inside the White House between the Democrats and the nationalists. The nationalists are going to lose. Just think of this in your own life. You're going to work. You have a boss who you, are close to and you have helped out, but you know that his tendency is to go the other direction away from you. But you've had a good run with him. Now you've had two really bad experiences with him, and he's kind of looking at you sideways. And his family has been looking at you sideways for a long time. And now his family members, he's starting to turn to his family members more and more. And you know when he turns to the family members, you know the family members are saying, you got to get rid of this guy. You got to get rid of this guy. This guy is no good. How many times does that happen before you start looking for a job? Now, you might stay and fight it out, but you're starting to look for a job. Okay? When the family member starts bringing in more people than you can bring in, that all agree with the family members, how long do you have? So Bannon, whether he knows it or not, he's a smart man, I'm sure he knows it, is done soon. His influence is gone. Now, one of the reasons why he has influence is because of the Mercer family. The Mercers are this family that really are propping up Breitbart. They're spending, $16 million of their own money at Breitbart. They are the reason why they've kind of pushed all of the Bannon stuff into the White House, because they came with money and said, hey, we'll help you, Donald Trump. We'll get you elected, but we want these things. Well, I think Donald Trump soon is going to say, you know what? I paid for those things. I did. I made some appointments based on your recommendations. I paid for those things. And this guy's given me advice that keeps losing, and I don't like to lose.
The New York Times reported that exact thing today.
What?
That is exactly how Trump is reacting right now to the Mercers specifically. That they
see
that's exactly. I mean, what
I'm telling
says.
You, this is not just probable. I think this is likely to be the story soon. So then, what happens? Bannon leaves. Now Bannon can leave the White House in shame, but he's also a guy that doesn't like to lose. Now, you can say that maybe he wants to stay and keep some connections with the White House, blah, blah, blah. But why? You're walking the walk of shame back to Breitbart after losing your job to a Democrat. Remember, it was your paper, your website that said, oh, no, that will never happen. He'll never turn left. He's one of us.
After you've been the man, too. I mean,
he's been the power broker. He's been the man.
Yes, he has.
And he was shown the door by the Democratic son-in-law. Now, Bannon has a guy. He's a guy who likes to. He's got an axe to grind. And he'll find an axe after axe after axe, and he'll grind them all day long. So what happens to Breitbart and Bannon? They start to become an anti-Trump site because Trump has abandoned his people. Remember, all that Bannon really wants is chaos. He wants to burn the whole system down. So that actually helps him by going now on the outside and say, I was part of it. But this guy is a sellout. This guy's dangerous. This guy went and he's a liar. He went and became a Democrat and brought all of his kids in. Well, now he's got the chaos because now he takes the Uber Trumpers and turns them against Donald Trump. The people who are in the middle who held their nose for Donald Trump are now seeing that Donald Trump is going to start looking at universal health care. That's not what they wanted. The left is going to smell blood in the water. Those in Congress who want to put the president in his place, they will do the investigations. And if they don't do the investigations on the midterm elections, oh, the Democrats will. I think you're looking at a lame duck president, if not now, very soon. What happens with Putin, what happens with this strike last night, if it goes well, it helps the president for a little while. But he better have a win here and a win for his base. And if Bannon leaves, I think you're looking at a lame duck president.
And as we are saying this, from Mike Allen, who, you know, very well-known insider in Washington, President Trump is considering a broad shakeup of his White House that could include the replacement of White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus and the departure of Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, aides and advisors tell us. Top aide to Trump says he's contemplating major changes, but the situation is very fluid at the time and it is uncertain. Things are happening, but it's very unclear that the president is willing to pull the trigger. Insiders say that the possibilities for Chief of Staff include Kevin McCarthy, House Majority Leader, Wayne Berman of Blackstone Group, a Washington heavy hitter who was an assistant secretary of commerce under George W. Bush, Dave Urban of the Washington advisory firm American Continental Group, former chief of staff to Arlen Specter.
Oh my gosh!
And Gary Cohn, Trump's economic advisor, former number two at Goldman Sachs, who is also close with Kushner. He's part of the sort of Kushner.
If he puts the Arlen Specter or the Goldman Sachs guy in, and Bannon leaves. You think Breitbart is not going to start spinning up that he's a Goldman Sachs guy?
All of a sudden, they'll care about Goldman
all
Sachs
sudden,
again.
All of a sudden, he'll be a globalist in the White House.
That'll be a fun throwback.
I think the obvious choice is the Arlen Specter guy.
Why would you say the Arlen Specter guy is the person who should be put into this particular role? Do you have any Pat, would you have any input on something?
There's not very often that we get a chance for you to do, Arlen Specter.
I didn't leave the Trump administration. The Trump administration left me.
I almost feel like he's back from the dead every time.
Now, can I take this one step further? You have a lame duck president, okay? If this would happen, you'll have a lame duck president that will only have executive orders and war to do. Executive orders and war. What usually happens when somebody wants to drive their ratings up? It's usually war or it's big gifts. If we have war, if North Korea becomes unstable, if the Middle East becomes really, truly unstable, if we go to war, look what happened last night. Gold went up $15. Stock market took a hit immediately last night. stock market is already losing money because they're saying, you know what, we baked in this cake some things that Donald Trump are going to do, and I don't think he's going to do it now. And so now the stock market is starting to retreat. We have a huge hit somewhere. All bets are off. All bets are off. Because when Ronald Reagan or somebody else said, hey, I'm going to have a big, huge shakeup in the White House, you usually went either that's bad because he's going to become softer with the press, you know, and he's going to care, or it's good because he's going to be a little stronger. I have no idea what this shakeup means. I have no idea. He's a wild card. Now, with Kushner getting so much power, it tells me that he's probably going to lean towards the Democrats now. But what does that mean? What does that mean for the economy? What does that mean for anything? What does that mean if we go to war?
And it's also amazing to see how the Democrats keep reacting to this, because if they played this smart, he is so vulnerable to agree with Democrats on every policy, Trump.
Oh, my gosh.
All you have to do is charm him.
Oh, yeah.
And instead, the day after inauguration, they're out there protesting.
So weird.
Thank God.
They will not.
How is it they haven't gotten that message?
Because they
all you have to do is say something nice about the guy and he loves
they
you.
They can't. I'm convinced of it. They can't.
Weird, though.
Because they've made him so toxic, and he is so toxic, that you just don't want to stand by him.
The fusion of entertainment and enlightenment.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
Let's turn to Stockholm, Sweden. This is going to play well for Donald Trump again. I mean, I hate to say it that way. Three people are dead, but it is in Sweden. Exactly, so where he said there's a problem in it, and everybody in the press, there's no problem in Sweden.
This seems to be the new MO of terrorism, right? Driving into a crowd.
I mean,
of people
that was part of that's part of what they called for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that is indeed what happened in Stockholm, and I thought nothing was going on in Sweden. I thought everything was fine. So isn't that what they said? What do you mean things are going on in Sweden? There's nothing happening.
How dare
Sweden,
you?
Sweden is on the. I mean, all of Europe is. All of Europe is. Europe is on the brink of disaster. And please don't listen to the mainstream media on this. It's Europe is on the brink of disaster, and it's for multiple reasons, but most of them revolve around multiculturalism.
By the way, the Daily Mail is now reporting at least 5 people dead. And 3 gunmen opened fire, too. So
more on that and Syria when we come back.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Pat, give me the update on, one, terrorism in Sweden, because nothing is wrong
nothing's
with Sweden.
Going, nothing's going on.
And there is absolutely no way anyone was shooting anyone in Sweden because they have strict gun laws. Anyway, go ahead.
Some of the strictest in the world. Up to 5 people, however, are believed to have been killed. Stolen truck rammed into shoppers in Stockholm, and then 3 men leaped out of the vehicle and opened fire on police who surrounded the vehicle. They also ran through the shopping center, stabbing and shooting at people.
How many wounded do you know yet?
It doesn't say here. At least 5 dead.
5 dead. There has to be more dead. Be more wounded.
More wounded. 2 suspects are thought to have been arrested.
Probably no description or any names attached or...
No, not no. yet.
Well, the Swedish government said that it appeared to be a terrorist attack.
Okay. All right, jumping into conclusions.
No doubt they're.
I know.
They're probably from
Protestants.
France.
Yeah, or? French Protestants,
yes.
Probably.
Yes.
So we'll
Ireland. We'll, love Irish.
Yeah. Well, there's Irish terrorism.
IRA.
So if they were terrorists,
IRA.
If the government's coming out in terrorists, they know that the IRA, the Irish, the fighting Irish. Hello.
Right.
So we'll keep you up to speed on that. And I'm sure there's going to be some huge surprises on who perpetrated that attack. Also with Syria, last night, 59 cruise missiles fired at an airbase in Syria where the sarin gas was believed to have been originated. Russia is in a tough spot here because Russia brokered the deal. It was Putin's credibility. Putin said, you know what, I've found out, no, we've gotten all of their chemical weapons. And so now, did you get all their chemical weapons? Did you even look for their chemical weapons? So he's under fire from the global community because he was the one that lied to the globe about chemical weapons with Assad. Now that he's used them, we've practiced this or rehearsed this for 2 days. And providentially, the president was meeting with the president of China last night. The reason why I say this is providential is because we have North Korea. North Korea is a much bigger problem than Syria. We cannot go it alone in North Korea. We strike North Korea. Kim Jong-un is crazy enough to launch nuclear missiles. He may not launch nuclear missiles, but he has enough artillery just to fire over the border, the demilitarized zone, and hit Seoul that within 2 hours, Seoul will be wiped out. How many people live in Seoul? Can you look up the...
Oh, I'd say 5 million or so.
Yeah, it's got to be. So...
But this the does
dead, the dead, the death toll will go through the roof. This is like World War II kind of scale conflict. We don't want to go that alone.
10 million
people. So why was this providential last night? Well, because the president has said in several statements he's done with North Korea. He'll go it alone. He doesn't matter. He doesn't care about what the world says. He's done with it. We didn't have any credibility with our allies and with our enemies abroad that we mean what we say. He said earlier this week that Syria would not go unpunished or unanswered. And we just answered it. And we answered it in a pretty ballsy way. And we did it while the president was having dinner with China. He's looking at the leader of China in the eye and saying, look, I don't care if anybody joins me or not. We are going to not let that stand. Which reminds me, we need to talk about North Korea because we won't let that stand either. China does not want us destabilizing that area. China has also not wanted to go in and do anything. They like it when we're busy with North Korea. But having us in there, like the Korean War, they're also not going to like. So perhaps Providence has lent its hand and help us make a case to China that you need to take care of North Korea so we don't have to.
And this may have, you know, put a little shock to little Kim in North Korea, too, saying, see, we will. There's a new sheriff in town.
Yeah, there's a possibility. Lauren Cooley is in town. Lauren is somebody who's been listening to this show for a long time. You were in high school when you started listening to the show?
Yep, high school.
Did your parents serve any time for that cruelty?
No, not at all. In fact, I was watching you on TV when my parents were watching one thing, and I was in the other room watching Glenn Beck on TV.
Wow, you were a weird kid. Wow.
Yes, that's true. I'm not going to deny it.
Yeah. So, and then when you were in high school, you read Common Sense.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's the book that made me decide I wasn't just a Republican, but I was actually a conservative, too. And probably conservative first and Republican second.
And why was that? Do you know?
I think it just kind of cut through all the talking points, and it said, like, here's some common sense. No pun intended, yeah. But here's some common sense issues that nobody's talking about. And it explained things so simply that it wasn't like you have to vote for this party or that party. It wasn't you have to toe the party line. It was these are things that are really going to help our country that make sense. They're things that have been around. It's not brand new. Why aren't we talking about these things? Why aren't we thinking about these things? And for me, it clicked and it made sense.
Wow. How old were you at the time?
I was 16 or 17.
Wow. How much would you love to have your 16 or 17-year-old reading on their own something like Common Sense and be like, I'm thinking about these big issues. That's remarkable. So then you live in Florida.
I do.
And you're doing a speaking tour now for college students.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, tell me about it.
Yeah, so during the election, I was helping students get out the vote and doing a big voter registration program. And then now the election's over. All right, what do we do on campus, right? And so all these students have come to me and they're like, hey, you gave me such great direction during the election, but now what? And so that's kind of the premise of the speaking tour. It's called Make Campus Great Again.
They're allowing you on campuses?
Some campuses where I can get away with it. Last night, we heard screaming and yelling outside the door, and we thought maybe it was protesters. It wasn't, but I thought that would give me some street credit. Going to different college campuses and basically saying, for so long, we've been playing defense. We wait around for some leftist group on campus to say, we hate the American flag, let's get rid of it. And then we start saying, oh, well, we love the flag, we want to keep it, and we're always playing defense. Why don't we go on offense for these America First policies that we care about? Instead of waiting for some kind of controversy on campus to happen, why don't we start pushing our agenda, going to the student government and saying, hey, we receive taxpayer dollars. We love our country. We want to always prominently display the American flag and get something passed as a resolution on the front end. That way we're not always playing defense. And it's multiple things, but that's a good example.
When you say multiple things, because you've said a couple of things that kind of put a red flag up in my head, and that's America First, that you have to be careful with America First.
Sure.
It's our principles first. Where do you stand on free speech on campus and safe spaces? And where do people your age stand on that?
Right. So to answer America First, what I always tell people is obviously when it comes to principles, everybody has equal intrinsic value, right? But when you come to a nation state, that's where you have to start deciding with a social contract, what is the role of that organization, that government? And so In that sense, that's what we're talking about, okay. America First policy.
Okay, all right.
Free speech on college campuses is such a difficult topic because it's not even that the administration wants to shut down other ideas, although a lot of times it is. They just like to have control, and they don't like any type of organized chaos. And so for college students on most campuses, and this is even worse on private campuses, there's something called a free speech zone. You can only articulate, you know, controversial values in this small little area. And so what I've actually encouraged students to do on this tour is to go out and purposefully provoke their administration into telling them that they're not allowed to be, you know, talking about some type of issue outside of the free speech zone. So to purposefully go and stand just outside of the free speech zone with a sign that says, you know, I'm not in the free speech zone. I have the First Amendment, you know, whatever it might be. And get that on film, get documentation so that they can actually go and use it either with the student government or trustees, or use it for media or even for a legal case and say, here's a documented example. We've actually shown the administration is trampling on our free speech rights, and then be able to make policy changes on campus.
But what do people, I mean, I would think that college students would be the first to say, don't trample on my right to speak in any direction. I mean, the reason we have tenure is so that 25 years ago, a professor could say, you know, global warming is going to happen and we're all going to die and we've got to ban oil because it was controversial.
Right.
And needed to make sure he could keep his job. Now we have to be able to have tenure. So some professor could say, you know, this global warming stuff is nothing but crap. On a university campus, it should be the place where you are the most uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. I think learning is supposed to be exploring new ideas, things that are uncomfortable. And what I've seen, at least, is when I was in undergrad about 4 or 5 years ago, free speech zones, trigger warnings, they weren't really that big of a thing. It's really even been in the last 5 years or so where the left has become so extreme.
Who's driving that? Is it the students? Is it the faculty?
I think it's our culture. And I think the culture comes from a lot of times these AstroTurf protests. That gets into the culture. Celebrities promote it. Different student groups on campus that are left-wing have different organizations that are funded maybe by George Soros, giving them talking points and different activism projects. And then that starts creating where it looks like it's natural and coming from the students.
And do the students, for the most part, left and right, agree with safe zones?
No, absolutely not. And that's what I was getting at is about 5 years ago, people didn't care one way or the other. But I think the farther left our culture gets, the more that people are going to push back. And that's what we're seeing even with teenagers in high school and now on college campuses, is that it used to be counterculture to be liberal. But now we see in, you know, Hollywood, in our government for the past 8 years, our culture, the normal culture, is this liberal, progressive, be nice, be politically correct. You can only use your free speech in a safe little box where it's away from everybody else. Young people like to be radical. They like to be counterculture. And I think that's where we're seeing conservative values come back, this push against political correctness, a push against trigger warnings. And it's really neat to see in actually polling and trending with younger generations, even younger than millennials, and then this new wave of college students now, as opposed to 5 years ago that were voting for President Obama. There's a pushback, and I'm really excited about seeing that on campus. And that's kind of what my tour is about, is these practical ways, these actual tactical steps they can take to make a difference and push back against these things.
Lauren Cooley, laurencooley.com is her web address, and you can find out more about her and what she's doing. Laurencooley.com. Nice to meet you.
And thank you for having
Thanks
me.
Thanks for coming by.
Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BACK.
Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So we've got North Korea, we've got Syria, and now
Sweden. Everything's fine.
Thinking about, you know, do you know that this November, I think 21st or 23rd, is my 21st year of sobriety?
No, really?
Wow. So I turn 21, which I believe is the universal date for
drinking age.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So. I believe I have graduated at my 21st birthday that I will be able to drink again.
In a dark moment, you will convince yourself that is true. That is a
luckily I won't. Mm. But
oh, it is true, Glenn.
Is it? You now, wait a minute. Stu, maybe you're right. Jeffy's making a good point here.
Well, it was not even a dark moment necessarily. Well, let me make it a little darker for you.
No, thank you.
Brett Baer reporting, Fox has learned a Russian warship has entered Eastern Mediterranean Sea heading towards two U.S. Navy destroyers that launched airstrikes last night.
Yes. They're going to protect the airspace now.
Yeah.
Wow. They're going to protect the airspace. They're going to make sure that we don't do anything like that again. Right. They're not going to launch against us. They're just going to stand guard and protect the airspace. That hurts Israel. That hurts us. But if Donald Trump does what he said in the campaign, which is walk away, let them have it. But I think there's going to be a negotiation for this, quite honestly. I think we're going to have to give up the missile shield. We talked about it earlier today. Yeah. I think we're gonna have to give up the missile shield, which would be horrible. In my opinion, that's horrible. That's giving Poland back to the former Soviet Union, Romania, Georgia, all of that. Just give it back.
I mean, if this is it, right? I mean, it's no one wants any of these things to happen. But if this is it, hopefully we can send a message and move on.
Yes.
You know, I that's my hope.
Yeah, my hope is that he struck. Divine Providence wakes China up, that they take care of North Korea. We leave Syria and Russia alone, and we go back to arguing about things that really are stupid.
Yeah, I mean, say what you want about Trump. He has some real smart military minds around him. I mean, you know,
yes,
Mattis and yeah. Master.
Yes,
I mean, it's not hopeless.
Yes, he does. Pray for our nation. Pray for our president.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.